Lord, we thank you for this morning. And God, I just pray that may it be head cold, may it just be the summer heat, the junky air, whatever may cause our heads to be foggy or distracted, Lord, you are greater than all of those. So Lord, I pray that your presence would just fill this room, fill us with your spirit, Lord. Would your presence be so known that it just clears away all the stuff that could get in the way. And so, Lord, I just pray that as we open up your word, that you would reveal yourself to us, Lord, that we could ultimately become more like you. In your son's name, amen. So, Daniel chapter 11 comes after Daniel chapter 10. Now, Daniel chapter 10, if you guys were here last week, was really just a setup. It's a preface to Daniel chapter 11. Just to give you guys a little heads up, that Daniel chapter 10, 11, and 12 are one event in Daniel's life. I think that's important for us to kind of start off and know. So Daniel chapter 10 was really leading us into this next chapter, and chapter 12 will cap it off, but it's all one event. And so in Daniel chapter 10, what we saw is that Daniel was dealing with just really a lot of depression. He had a lot of sorrow going on in his life, and we saw that the way that he dealt with that sorrow and depression was actually denying the urge to gratify his flesh, whatever desires you have, whatever that would be. Sometimes when we get stressed, whenever we get upset, we can turn to things that we want to just make ourselves feel happy. For me, again, I kind of threw it out there. Me, it's always those nice frozen peanut butter cups that you find in the freezer. But Daniel doesn't go there. Daniel goes like the exact opposite way. Daniel goes into a time of denying himself physical pleasure, so that way he could understand more about what's going on in his life. And after persevering for 21 days in denying himself, going through this time, what we see is that Daniel ends up seeing a man who is very much described the way that Jesus is described in the book of Revelation. And then after seeing this man, Daniel falls on his face, and an angel picks him up and tells him, look, from the moment that he started praying, the moment he humbled himself and when he came before God, that God sent word to him. And I want us to understand that. What this angel is letting him know is it wasn't because you went to some religious practice of fasting, though God honors self-denial, tells us to deny ourselves and take up our cross. Though he honors that God's wanting Daniel to say, look, the fact that you came with your heart humbled, that's when I sent my message. It had nothing to do with this period of time. But then he tells them it's taken 21 days because there is spiritual warfare going on. And this angel says that there's actually, in this spiritual warfare, it hindered this word coming to Daniel. Now, upon hearing this, Daniel, poor Daniel. Daniel's like 80 plus years old, like in his 90s. And so he saw this man, he passed out and fell down. The angel picks him up. Daniel's sitting there trembling. And the angel says, look, I was coming to you, but there's a spiritual warfare on. And you just see Daniel get wobbly. And he falls to the ground again. And on the ground, he's just telling this angel, like, I don't even have any strength left. I don't even know if I can talk to you. And it's in that moment that the angel reminds Daniel that he is greatly loved by God. And he reminds him to be strong. Tells Daniel, yes, be strong. And what we see in that moment is that Daniel is actually strengthened by the message of God's love for him. That as the angel is reminding him that he is greatly beloved, that Daniel is filled with the new strength. And then starts telling the angel, I want to hear more. Your words of reminder, your words of love from God, they're actually strengthening me and I want to hear more. And so it's with all of that that we come to Daniel chapter 11. Starting in verse 1, and it says, also in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up and to confirm and strengthen him. Now, I don't want us to get lost because there's a lot of time jumping that happens in the Bible. There's been a lot of time jumping happening here in Daniel alone. And so I don't want anyone to get lost here when this angel is telling him in the first year of Darius the Mede. I'm going to read that again. It says, also I in the first year of Darius the Mede, the angel talking about himself, even I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. What this angel is telling Daniel, and this is important not to gloss over this. Now, we don't know this angel's name like we've been told Gabriel and Michael, but this angel talking to Daniel is saying, in that first year of Darius, if you guys remember to Daniel chapter 6, that was when Daniel was thrown in the lion's den. And what was it that shut the mouth of a lion? It was the angel. And this angel is telling Daniel, as he's talking to him, he has reminded him of his love. He said, by the way, I, me, this angel standing here, I was there when you were thrown in the pit. I was there when Darius made this mistake. God has had me watching over you, and I was there when you went through this trial. And that's this angel who is speaking to Daniel. Now, chapter 11, this chapter goes into such intricate details of history, unlike anything we've read so far. The prophecy that Daniel is receiving here in chapter 11, it is so precise that, again, critics say that there is no way that this could have been written before the events that happened, because it's so right on, this had to be written as historical reference. What I'm going to say is I'm going to let the critics' own strong stance against God's word explain to you and tell you the truth of the matter. What we are about to read in Daniel chapter 11 is, in fact, confirmed to be history. These are factual events that happen down to the smallest intricate detail that Daniel is not going to be referencing history, but this is actually an angel telling him events that are going to happen 50, 100, 200 years from the moment that we are reading, from the moment that Daniel is receiving this. And that actually chapter 11 is going to go all the way out to a future that we ourselves have not actually even experienced yet. So, because of the great detail of Daniel chapter 11, I'm actually going to move through this chapter more in an overview type way. I don't want us to get bogged down with the insane amount of detail information of these verses. So we're going to kind of look at this more of great sections of overview. With that, what I mean is that there are going to be references to kings. I'm not going to be going over every king's name. For one, I'd probably just keep mumbling through and messing up their actual names. But so for that, and for other reasons, we're going to make some references to the kings, but I'm not going to get down into all the precise details. I would just say this, if this excites you guys, if you guys like history, then you know what? Go back through. There'll be plenty of reference points for you guys to go back, look over this stuff, overlay it with Daniel chapter 11, and enjoy. For those of you who can't stand history, hold on. Here we go. All right. Daniel chapter 11, verse 2 says, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece." Now, again, for those who don't like history, this may not mean much, but if you've taken on any history in the past, you understand that the Persians and the Greeks had some of the most fierce battles the world has ever known. And when it came to the fourth king mentioned here, he was one of the most intense fighters, intense leaders, a king of Persia by the name of Xerxes, the fourth king of Persia mentioned here. Now, if that name Xerxes rings a bell to anyone, it might be a couple reasons. Maybe for some, it's from the graphic novel turned movie that starred Gerard Butler called The 300. Where the 300 Spartans fought against all of the craziness that was the Persian army. And now that is a fictional, over-stylized movie, but it was an actual event in history where 300 Greeks would take on the armies of Xerxes, and it would begin a battle after battle, a back-and-forth war of hatred between the Greeks and the Persians. If you guys remember back, we heard when Daniel was receiving one vision about this goat that seemingly came out of nowhere, and he didn't even touch the ground, and it said that he flew across the world, and it struck the ram with fierce anger. That is because the Greeks and the Persians had such differing ideologies that their battles were intense, and they clashed. Now, for others, the name Xerxes might stir up something else. You might remember hearing about the king Xerxes in the book of Esther. Now, what's to understand there is that same Xerxes that we know from history, that same one who in the book of Esther is described as insanely violent, that he would, they give this idea of he was out there, he was angry at the ocean, he's like trying to whip the ocean with a whip. Xerxes was insanely violent. That Xerxes, we know from the book of Esther, is the same king that this Hebrew girl would end up marrying. And Esther's uncle Mordecai would tell Esther of a plot by a man named Haman, an Amalekite, to try and wipe out and kill all the Jews. And Mordecai would come to Esther and remind her, God is in control. Your marriage to this King Xerxes was planned by God to save the people. In fact, in Esther chapter 4, verse 14, Mordecai says, "For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance from the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your fathers will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." That he is coming to let her know that, yes, this is this crazy powerful king. And yes, he has killed people who come before him without asking. But Mordecai comes to us and says, "But God has placed you here by his side to save God's people." Continue on in Daniel chapter 11, verse 3, it says, "Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these." Now, this is not new information for us. This is once again Daniel being told and us hearing about the coming Alexander the Great. Now, we know from everything that we've covered and from history that Alexander the Great would conquer the world at a very young age, and that he would actually die at 32, a very young age, and that his kingdom would be split up by his four generals into four. Now, it wasn't split into four generals because he didn't have sons. His sons were murdered. And then these four generals would actually end up taking his kingdom and splitting them up, and that then they would split this kingdom. But it wasn't because they all got along. In fact, it was not a very amicable split. That these generals would actually then establish themselves as kings over these geographical areas, and they would constantly be at war with each other. Now, as we move through the rest of the chapter, a majority of this chapter is in reference to the Greek general kings of Syria, called the Seleucids, and they are going to be fighting the Greek general kings of Egypt called the Ptolemies. Now, that's about as much detail as we're going to go into all of that, but that's what I'm saying. If you guys want to get into the nitty-gritty and awesome stuff, just look up the wars between the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. Now, I do want to just acknowledge, yes, in history, there were other dynasties, there were other empires, the Mongolians, the Incas, the Aztecs. So why do we focus on these empires? Well, the Greek kings over the land of Syria, the Seleucids, they're going to be called throughout this chapter the kings of the north. And the Greek kings over the land of Egypt, the Ptolemies, they're going to be called the kings of the south. North and south of what? Of Israel. These empires are presented to us as north and south on how they relate and impact the land and people of Israel. So with that, starting in chapter 5 of Daniel 11, we look at the warring kings of north and south. Now, it says, "Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion, and at the end of some years they shall join forces. For the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times." What is going on? Okay, here's what's going on. So the king of the south in Egypt is fighting the king of the north in Syria. And the king of the south, they've been fighting for so long, he tries a different strategy. The king of the south gives his daughter to the king of the north as like a peace offering, trying to take a different tactic. Don't be confused. This guy isn't just trying to do peace. What he's trying to do is he's giving his daughter as a peace offering with the plan that as his daughter marries the king of the north, she will have children, and those children will be loyal to Grandpappy down in the south. Now, it's actually a plan that when you look throughout history, the Europeans use it all the time. And they make great messes of it. And you know what? For a while, this plan of the king of the south, it worked. Now, I just want you guys to remember this. This is all history. You can go back and look at it. This known history is so detailed that the critics passionately hate this chapter of Daniel. Now, as some of you know, I love history. But again, for those of you who don't, just try and hang on, because we've got some fun stuff coming. So, quick little bit of info to give you. So, that king of the north, he's given a wife to be married by the king of the south. A little background info, he already had a wife. he divorces his wife to marry the daughter of the king of the south. Plan's working so far. But then, failure. The king of the south dies. The king of the north says, well, then I don't need your daughter as a peace offering. He divorces his wife, sent by the king of the south, who he had already had a son by, and remarries his wife that he already had before. Okay? Now, as you can imagine, there is no scorn like a woman's hatred. That first wife was not happy about any of this stuff going on. The first wife of the king of the north has a son and comes up with a plan. She poisons her husband, he dies, and then she murders the daughter from the south and all her children. So, plan completely falls apart, but that is exactly what we read just happened. Well, the new king of the south is son of the old king, brother to the daughter who just got murdered, along with his nephews and nieces. So you can imagine, the brother in the south hears about this, he is none too happy, and well, what do you know, look at verse 7, but from a branch of her roots, speaking of the brother, one shall arise in his place who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. This is awesome! This is prophesied history that we're reading through, but it looks more like some sort of reality TV show that we could be watching. But the thing is that this is history. Read about this. But for Daniel, this is history in the making. Again, this is some 50, 100, 200 years out that's taking place. Continue on, verse 9. It says, also, the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now, there has again been this constant fighting between the armies of north and south. And as the war is raging on, what we heard going on there is this is like some violent, trumped-up version of tug-of-war, where as they're fighting to control the majority of the land, right there in the middle is the nation of Israel. And because it was the middle ground, they were always fighting to take control of that. Because whoever could take the middle ground had the majority and thus was seen as the majority ruler. So as this tug of war is going back and forth, many times their battles were fought right in Israel. Now again, just real quick to recap what we just read through. So that series of battles we just read through in those verses goes something like this. The north takes on the south. They lose. Well, the south is not so happy they just got attacked, so they fight back. And they're doing some major damage. The south does some major damage. But as the north retreats, they just get a whole bunch of reinforcements, and they come and they send the south packing. And they take back over. Now, verse 14 says, now in those times, many shall rise up against the kings of the south. Also, violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of this vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist, but he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. So from the last battle that we heard where the north won, we're told that some time goes by. Again, we're not going to get into the details of the history. Go look it up. But the south comes back and takes over Israel. Now again, I gave you some of this information to understand something. The south is Egypt, the land from which the Israelites came out of. Though it's under Greek rule, Egypt is ruling over Israel, and they are not happy about that. So what actually ends up happening is after some time gets by, the Israelites are tired of Egypt ruling over them. So they actually form like this local militia, join in with the king of the north from Syria to push out Israel, or to push out the south from Israel. And so the northern kingdom once again takes the glorious land that is Israel. Verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it. But she shall not stand with him or before him. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end. And with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. So, what is happening here? Beginning in verse 17, is there is a northern king who gets tired of all this back and forth fighting. He gets it in his head, I will be the next Alexander the Great. He wants to take over all four empires again. And so this northern king from Syria is going to go on a campaign to try and take over all of Greece. He's done with the whole four thing. He believes himself to be that strong. He does try a tactic we've heard about. If you notice, it says that he sent his daughter. So the king from the north tries what the king of the south had done many, many years ago. And so the king from the north sends his daughter to the king of the south in Egypt and says, hey, why don't we get peaceably? The whole thing falls apart because, well, his daughter was not faithful to the king in the south. In fact, she was known to be quite promiscuous and was just kind of hooking up with all kinds of other dudes. And the whole plan falls apart. And so it's not going to be peaceably. So he tried this like peaceable negotiation thing. It didn't work. So he goes on the offensive. This northern king, by force, is going to start trying to take over the different Grecian lands. He starts heading towards Asia Minor. Then what we find out happens is it says that this small leader sends him back. As he heads towards Asia Minor, a Roman general, yes, this is the first time we're hearing about this, the Romans, who though small, are starting to gain notoriety for their fierceness in battle. And though small, as this northern king comes into the area where Rome is beginning, they are going to push this man back and they completely take him out. Now, what ends up happening is that this wannabe Alexander the Great is stopped by the Roman forces. He is completely embarrassed and he has spent all of his money trying to fight against the Romans, and then it gets worse. Because the rest of the Grecian empires go, we are holding you financially responsible. We were all okay with being these four kingdoms. You wanted to try to be Alexander the Great. You went on this great siege. We hold you financially responsible for the entire war. The guy is broke. He has no money. Then what happens is, if you guys notice there, it says that verse 19, he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Basically, his end is just kind of like a nothing, a blip in history. Because what happens is, as this wannabe Alexander the Great is completely defeated by this Roman general, and then he's held responsible by the Grecian Empire, is he's broke. On his way back to his land, north, Syria, Babylon was there. We know from history, he goes into a Babylonian temple and tries to loot it to steal the money. The local Babylonians are not okay with that and kill him. So it's over. Verse 20, there shall arise in his place of this wannabe Alexander, one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. So what happens is, the son of this fallen king goes, well, great, dad left me with all this debt. What do? I know. I'll raise the taxes. And so he imposes taxes on the people of Israel, and he is murdered by poison, by his brother. So this murderous brother is a man we've heard before, a man by the name of Antiochus Epiphanes. Now again, if that sounds familiar to anyone, it's because this man, Antiochus Epiphanes, would be an Old Testament illustration of the coming Antichrist. Verse 21, we continue, speaking of this man, this Antiochus Epiphanes, this Old Testament Antichrist, it describes him as, and in his place shall arise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches. And he shall devise his plan against the strongholds, but only for a time. So what Antiochus Epiphanes did is his brother was taxing everyone. Is this guy comes on the scene and goes, hey, I know what I'll do. I'm going to redistribute the wealth, all the spoils and plunders. Tell you what, you guys work for me, and I'll let you have all the goods. We'll spread it evenly among. Generals, if you do really good, you'll get even more. And so he's redistributing wealth. He's kind of taking a different tactic. He's trying to be cunning. He's using bribery to get these people on his side. Verse 25 says, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand. For they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant. So he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So, this Old Testament Antichrist uses bribery. He uses flattery. He pretends to be the friend of the king of the south. All the while, he is planning a massive invasion of the south. And he invades. He's pretending to be friend. He's doing all this bribery to try and get all the men on his side. And he moves against the king of the south in what should be an easily sweeping victory. Except we find out, again, in history, that this becomes one of the major decisive battles for the Roman navy. See, the south calls on Rome's help once again. And much like how his dad was defeated, Rome shows up, stops the armies of Antiochus Epiphanes, and then they come to tell him, guess what? Greece, their time is over. The Roman Empire tells you, you have to go home. You have to leave. And in front of all his men, Antiochus Epiphanes tries to give this Roman general kind of a, well, let me talk about it with my leaders, and we'll decide if we're going to go. Again, I love these moments in history. It's like something out of a movie, but this is reality. This Roman general takes his staff and draws a circle in the sand around Antiochus Epiphanes and tells him, take all the time you need, but you will give me your answer before you step a foot out of that ring. And Antiochus Epiphanes knows exactly what this man's talking about. He feels the intimidation, and he backs down. And with tail between his legs tucked, he heads back. He heads back embarrassed like his dad was. And as he is going back to Syria, he has to go back via the way of Israel. And this Antiochus Epiphanes is fuming. Not only did his world conquest come to an end, Rome is coming on scene, and they embarrassed him. And it is with that much rage, it is with that much just ferocity that he turns all of his hatred, all of his anger on the people of Israel as he comes back into the land of Israel, and as he sees these people who are supposed to be under Greece's rule, they're not following their gods, they're not following their customs, and so this man takes all his, how dare you disobey me? Again, he called himself Epiphanes because he thought himself to be illuminated, godlike, and he attacks and goes after the people of Israel. He would be called the madman by the people of Israel because in one day he would kill some 80,000 Jews. He would go on a slaughter, on a rampage. This is the man who, in his anger, would set up an idol of Zeus in their temple, sacrifice a pig on that altar, and spread pig's blood, desecrating the temple all over. And he did all of that to throw in their face, I am your God. Even though he was just defeated, this is just a poor little boy lashing out in anger. We continue on in verse 30, and it says, so he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the covenant. I'm going to read that again. So he comes to Israel. He is angry. He is hacking people apart. He is doing atrocities. He is desecrating the temple. And it says at the end of verse 30, he shall show regard for those who forsake the holy covenant. So you understand what's happening. What we also know is because Antiochus Epiphanes, a civil war starts between the people of Israel. Because they get tired of standing out. They don't look like Greeks. They don't follow their customs. And he is killing them for it. And so what we know from history is quite a few handful of the Jews go, we're tired of this. We're tired of the slaughter. We're tired of standing out. We're tired of the persecution. And they forsake the covenant to follow this man who stands in the image of the Antichrist. And verse 31 says that that forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. They shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do so, who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. See, we also talked about what we know is because of these actions by Antiochus Epiphanes that a family will lead a group of Jews, the Maccabees, and they will march back into the temple. And from this violent Greek ruler, they are going to push the Greeks out of the temple and rededicate the temple. And that, again, is what we talked about, is that what the Jews celebrate as Hanukkah was that rededication of the temple. And it says that the people who know their God shall be strong. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, that they shall be aided with little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. What we find out again is after this craziness of Antiochus, this antichrist-like man who's coming in, declaring himself to be God, desecrating the temple, this abomination of desolations, that as God's people stand up, the civil war begins to end and the Jews open their eyes and they turn back, they fall, and all of Israel starts to rally around because God was faithful to those who stood their ground for his name. And some of those of the understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the end of time, because it is still for the appointed time. I want you guys, I try to make it clear how many times throughout this prophecy of Daniel that Daniel is being told the appointed time, the appointed time for such a time as this. God is in control. No matter what you're going through, no matter what craziness is being thrown at you, to understand that God is fully aware of all of history and he has promised to stand right there with us and be faithful to his people. The question is will you stand out despite any persecution? When the world turns on us, when the world sees Christians as haters, as bigots, as hateful, when the world comes to take things away and sees, will we stand up for the name of God as people who know their God, or instead serve the instead of Jesus theology of the Antichrist? I just want to leave us with one verse. Matthew 16:25. It says, for whoever desires to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. That was Jesus talking. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. That is the question that all of us will face today. Do we stand trusting in a God who is fully in control, who knows all of history played out, and says that those who know their God will be strong? Or will we give in to the fear and weakness of self-gratification? Let's pray. God, thank you so much for this morning. Lord, I pray that all of us would not feel guilted, would just be encouraged by your faithfulness, by who you are, that your word is true. That, Lord, that even though we may go through trials, you have told us that in this world we will have tribulation, but to be of good cheer because you have overcome the world, and that is just as true as this prophecy Daniel received. So, Lord, I just pray that you would continue to grow us in you, make us more like you, so that we can reflect who you are to a world that desperately needs to know you. In your son's name, amen.